Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books in Fantasy and Adventure, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This is your host, Gabrielle Matthew, author of the historical fantasy Falcon series and Girl of Fire, the first in a YA fantasy series. My January interview is with Ilona and Gordon Andrews, a couple who write under the name Ilona Andrews. We'll be discussing Emerald Blaze, which is the fifth in the Hidden Legacy series. I read it as a standalone, and it wasn't difficult to follow. Here's the plot. Catalina Baylor is the titular prime of House Baylor, where she and her crew, including her dangerous cousin Leon, engage in detective work. She's also secretly the deputy to Texas Warden, charged with keeping the potent serum that creates magical powers out of the hands of evildoers. She's just picked up the pieces of her broken heart and set her mind to keeping her extended family safe when a new challenge disrupts her life. Four of Houston's most powerful houses have a business deal with a nasty old codger by the name of Lander Morton. The focus of this deal is the Swampy Pit, which is full of magical hazmat. Once it's cleaned up, there's a fortune to be made in real estate development. When Landers Morton's son is tortured and killed on site of the pit, Morton is convinced one of the other houses is behind it. In addition to hiring Catalina to conduct an investigation, he also hires a suave Italian assassin to kill whoever Catalina identifies as the perpetrator. The problem? The assassin is Alessandro, Catalina's ex, who walked out on her and left her bereft. Now Alessandro claims he took the job with Morton in order to protect her. But can she believe him? It's an entertaining and fun read with romantic sizzle. You can read about Ilona's initial journey to publication and find out all about the many series that she and Gordon write under her website, https://ilonaandrews.com. Ilona is native-born Russian, and Gordon is a former communication sergeant in the U.S. Army. Contrary to popular belief, Gordon was never an intelligence officer with a license to kill, and Ilona was never the mysterious Russian spy who seduced him. They actually met in college, in English Composition 101, where Ilona got a better grade. Gordon is still sore about that. And now for a short reading. The prologue. The wolf was coming. Lander Morton knew this because he'd invited the wolf into his home. His body man, Sheldon, had come to tell him the wolf was at the door and had gone to fetch him. Now the two of them were coming back, but Lander only heard one set of footsteps echo throughout the house. He shifted in his wheelchair and took a long swallow of his bourbon. Fire rolled down his throat. His old guts would make him pay for it later, but he didn't care. Some men were men and others were wolves in human skin. He needed a human wolf for this job, and he would get one. For the first time in the last 3 days, he felt something other than crushing grief. This new emotion cut through the thick fog of despair, and he recognized it as anticipation. No, it was more than that. It was a heady mix of expectation, apprehension, and excitement tinged with fear. He used to feel like this years ago when he was on the verge of closing a huge deal. It happened decades since he'd experienced a splash of adrenaline, and for a moment he felt young again. Sheldon appeared in the doorway of the study and stood aside, letting the other man enter. The guest took 3 steps inside and stopped, letting himself be seen. He was young, so young, and he moved with an easy grace that made Lander feel ancient. Strong, tall, handsome in that Mediterranean way, shaped by sun and salt water. When Felix's boy grew up, he might look like that. Pain lashed him, and Lander struggled with it. His guest waited. Lander looked at his face. There it was, in the eyes, the wolf looking back at him, cold, hungry. And you'll learn all about the wolf soon. His name is Alessandro. As my guests today, I have a husband and wife writing team, Ilona and Gordon, who wrote Emerald Blaze, which is book 5 of the Legacy series, the book I've been talking about. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for having us. Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, and thanks for taking time out of your schedule. So I'm going to jump right in and talk about Catalina. She's the heroine of this book, and people are really taken by her. She's a strong heroine, but she's also very vulnerable. We're introduced to her crew in the first chapter, and she and her crew are obviously people with moral principles. When we first meet them, she's taken on a pro bono case to retrieve a helper animal, a golden tamarind monkey, and reunite it with its owner, a young girl in a wheelchair. So she's a pretty nice person. We know she's angry at Alessandro for leaving her without explanation. But doesn't it trouble her that he's an assassin?
Well, yes, of course it does. Part of the reason why she explores all of this in Emerald Blaze is specifically because he is an assassin. She ran a background on him. She was trying to find answers. Why did he become the assassin? What kind of assassination jokes did he take? And she actually found more questions rather than answers. This becomes somewhat more clear in the narrative as the book progresses as to what kind of assassination does Alessandro really do.
Well, and also I have to jump into Alessandro's defense and say he only kills other assassins, so I feel like that's sort of a mitigating factor. You know, it's kind of like the True Lies thing where he's like, she's like, you killed a bunch of people. And he's like, yeah, but they're all bad people. So
it's good that he's meeting Catalina so he gets a chance to make his case. He's actually not a bad guy, is he?
No, he's not a bad guy.
Well, Catalina has a boss. That's Texas Warden Linus. He gives Catalina a special present. A plain short sword, and she's touched that he made a sword for her because she knows his specialty is projectile weapons. Now, why would he make a sword for Catalina? Tell us a bit about her weapons preference.
Catalina's magic is related to her family bloodline. Most of the people in her family are actually Sagittarius mages, which means that they are very precise when they're firing projectile weapons. For Catalina, the talent manifested more in bladed weapons. She's very precise with her rapier. She can strike at the exact weakness that her opponent has. And so when Linus makes her sword, the sword is special. It has some magical properties. In that world, the magic is treated more like science rather than magic. So the sword is actually a marvel of magical engineering. And it will give Catalina an edge when she most needs it.
Yeah, I mean, short answer for me is that he knows she's much better with a bladed weapon than she is with projectile weapons. If, for instance, he was making a weapon for Leon, obviously it would be some type of firearm. And I think that, to me, that's a touching thing, that he knows her abilities, her capabilities, and makes something that's much more suited to her than simply like a magic gun.
And it's definitely, it may appear to be a plain short sword, but it is much more than it appears to be.
Yeah.
So Catalina asks, we learn a lot more about her family as the book unfolds. And she has two grandmothers. They're very different in character. So tell us about each and how they enrich or obstruct her life.
You know, I think it's like, Grandma Frieda is the grandma that you wish you had, and Victoria Tremaine is unfortunately the bad grandma that you might have.
Mm-hmm.
I that's the difference, kind of. If you boil it down, you know, Grandma Frieda is like a lot of people in that world. They have magic, but they're not necessarily combatants. She's your normal person. Victoria Tremaine is like magic nobility. She's incredibly powerful. She's from a powerful family. And it's almost those two worlds that the kids that are the grandchildren, both of them live in, sort of being between those two extremes of basically Grandma Frieda almost being like a blue-collar, mechanic-y person. She does have magic. And then Victoria being a very, very powerful mental mage. You know, she's rich, or she was. She's probably still rich.
Yeah, she's rich.
And, you know, she puts a lot of stock into her idea of family, which is also a little bit different than Grandma Frieda's idea of family. I think it's just those two extremes.
Yeah, Grandma Frieda, you know, she kind of got to have a happy life. She married for love. She had a fulfilling career in the army as a mechanic. She had children, although, you know, one Giselle is not a super awesome daughter, but Penelope turned out to be okay. Penelope is Catalina's mother. You know, she has grandchildren. She has warmth and light and basically what we typically aim for as humans, you know, companionship, happy family, where, you know, Victoria Tremaine was denied all those things. Yes, she's rich and she is extremely powerful, but she is also very lonely. She was alone most of her life. Her only son, which she had gone through horrible lengths to give birth to, basically ran away from her.
Yeah, he essentially rejected everything that she stood for, thought was important.
Exactly.
And split, like.
Yeah, he took off. And so for her to suddenly find this new family, I think that she is quite desperate to keep them all safe. In her eyes, they're basically babies who are floundering about in the shark-infested waters that are, you know, that is that magical world. And she is just trying to keep them safe by any means necessary. And sometimes those means are extremely cruel.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I think that both grandmothers have sort of the same goal in mind. They want their grandchildren to be, you know, healthy, happy, successful. It's just they're going about it in an extremely very different way.
I don't think Victoria cares so much if they're happy.
I think Victoria cares if they're happy. But the happiness is very low. The survival is very high.
Yeah.
It's fun having both of you on the show. So do Alessandro and Catalina work well together as a team? I mean, she's disappointed in him. He's jealous. How is their teamwork progressing as the book goes on?
Well, I think their teamwork progressing great. They click right away. And, you know, her disappointment with him, I don't know that I would use that way to characterize their relationship. She wasn't disappointed. She was hurt. You know, that's a little bit different. Where his jealousy doesn't really play into picture at all, in the sense that he, when the book starts, he knows that he's screwed up royally, and he doesn't think that there is a chance that they would be together. He's solely there to protect Catalina because she's literally the most important person in his life. He knows that she's in danger. He knows that she cannot handle the danger by herself because the adversary is very, very powerful. And so he's there to make sure that she survives this trial, kind of. it's not like he says in the book, it's not, keeping her safe is not everything he wants, but he will settle for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think as far as their teamwork, that's why it hurt so much at the end of the previous book, is that in her mind, they did work really well together. They clicked, and then he split. He left, you know, and what she thought, what they had was pretty good. And, you know, she wondered, well, maybe he didn't think so, you know. So I do think once they get over their stuff, they do work well together.
So now she's having a chance to get Alessandro to open up to her. Things have shifted in his life, and he's sharing more information about his emotional state. In fact, she asks him what his greatest hope in life is, and he tells her, what is it?
I think that Alessandro, at that point in life, Alessandro basically greatest hope is surprisingly that Catalina would be happy. He wants for her to be happy. It's kind of a very unselfish thing of him because,
yeah, whether she's happy with him or not.
Yeah, he wants her to have a happy, fulfilling life, kind of. You know, he wants her to get to do all the things that she wants to do. Alessandro is kind of a very damaged guy. His family treated him very badly, in a sense that they only wanted to use him for their purposes. Nobody had actually asked Alessandro, what do you want? What do you want out of life? What would make you happy? And so when he first time met Catalina all those years ago, and she told him, she said, I want you to have a happy life. I want you to get to do all the things you want to do. It was almost like a lightning bolt, because nobody up to that point had ever basically inquired or showed any interest in figuring out what it is that made him tick. So now he kind of just wants the same for her. That's it. His hope is very small, but, you know, it's a very heartfelt hope. Yeah.
I'm kind of struck that Alessandro and Victoria Tremaine have one thing in common, though probably not much. They both, the security and happiness of their family is very important to them. And Alessandro does say that too. He's still, he's obviously devoted to Catalina, but he's devoted to his remaining family at home too and wants them safe.
Yeah, mainly his mom and his sister. That's the thing. That's kind of why he does all the things he does, is to kind of keep them safe.
Yeah.
Make sure that they have enough money. It's a difficult situation with his grandfather.
His grandfather is very domineering. His grandmother and his mother are kind of weak, and they're weak by design. That family basically, I don't want to spoiler the book, but mm-hmm. The family basically has a problem that they've been solving by successive marriages. And so, you know, When that's your aim, you want kind of a docile partner, so the partner can be used. And that's what it is. So they're not necessarily able to, you know, stand up for themselves in the same way that Alessandra can. Alessandra's sisters, however, are just like him.
Okay. So when Catalina and Alessandra are working together to solve this mystery, they encounter something new and unexpected in their investigation. It's an animated construct that appears to be innately intelligent. What is the significance of that, and what would make such a thing especially dangerous?
Well, in that world, the magical constructs are usually produced by animator mages, people who are able to kind of take ordinary objects and bind them together into kind of creatures or automatons via magical means. And this particular construct was made by application of some forbidden, basically, magic. It is self-replicating, meaning that it is self-aware, and it is also able to repair itself. So, you know, if you hack a piece of it off, it will just grow a new piece. So it's basically kind of unkillable unless you can get all of it together in one spot. And as the book progresses, it becomes evident that this construct has spread through the area where it was released. And it really views humans as a kind of resource, you know, that it uses for further expansion.
Well, yeah, and that's why when we talked about this at some point, Mom was like, you know, this really isn't like our normal murder mystery. This is a creature feature. And I was like, yeah, it kind of is. But it made the creature that, you know, that thing that was made using Forbidden. Obviously, there's allusions to Shelley and Frankenstein, but like it was a creature that he didn't ask to be born. It was created using, you know, very technology. And it's really, in a sense, I feel sympathetic because it just wants to survive.
It wants to survive, but it also basically quickly figured out it's kind of superior to humans. And so,
yeah, it is.
It can just absorb human pieces into it, which makes it sound kind of grisly. It's almost like a modern art construction.
Yeah, well, you know, we like to push the boundaries a little bit. Typically, romance genre and horror genre do not cross over that much unless it's in the form of, like, a gothic, you know. But I think that the modern audiences are conditioned to expect better monsters. We have such wonderful, basically, films and books, and the genre has extended so much that we felt comfortable including kind of a grisly, odd creature into
our world. Well, yeah, I mean, if he didn't do that, he kind of wouldn't be the villain. Be in the pit minding his own business.
Hi, I'm here. I'm doing my thing.
It'd be awful if they just went in and killed him. That would be terrible.
Yes, you know, we try to... The Hidden Legacy as a series is over the top. You know, it's over, everybody is very handsome or very beautiful and dangerous, and their magic is really vivid. And, you know, tempers fly and all of this. So, of course, it required a really scary macabre villain kind of to offset the heroes.
To keep up with the impossibly handsome heroes and angel-winged heroine.
Well, it's Dynasty. It's Falcon Crest. It's, you know, all the beautiful people that are inexplicably rich and
or you know, trying to get there and are getting murdered left and right, you know. And at some point it kind of turned into, what is it, Midsummer Nights, right?
That tiny village where there's
British village where there's murder every day. And like,
it's gotta be the per capita murder capital of the world.
Yes, how they did not give up.
We watch a lot of British television shows.
Well, it sounds like you guys have a lot of fun trading ideas back and forth. You know, my husband and I tried writing together when we met. He has a background in journalism. Every time I'd create some original metaphor, take a flight of imagination, he'd say, well, how does this work exactly? So now I write alone. And I'm just curious, how did the two of you manage to work together so well? What's your process for writing a book?
You know, we started writing together. It kind of, I want to say it grew kind of organically. We met in college and we started dating. We were in the same class and we started working on each other's papers. Like, for instance, I may have been slightly better at history and English, where Alona was better in some of the sciences. And we would start by proofreading each other's papers and adding some suggestions. And like, I don't want to say, for purposes of not getting my degree revoked, that we wrote each other. I understand, but we collaborated.
Yeah, we collaborated, and you know,
it started many years ago. Now, almost 20 years ago.
We've been married for a while, and so we tend to think in similar ways. I think that our collaboration works because we try to compensate for each other's weaknesses. We do have spats over it occasionally, you know, over word usage, or, you know, one of us sometimes will throw their hands and like, I'm done for the day, I'm going, you know. But
I can't work with you when you're like this.
Yes, I can't work with you.
I'm going to the house dramatically because our office is like 50 feet from the house.
Oh.
Yes, but it doesn't allow us to stock out.
To stomp out and go, I'm going home. You know, so, but... overall, if it made it into the book, it was a compromise.
Yeah. Or we both just agreed to it. Like, yeah, that's good.
That's good. The toughest moments for us are when it's not going well. When it's not going well, and we know we made the wrong turn somewhere, but we don't know what the wrong turn is.
Yeah, but we both know we're in the wrong place. And, of course, I won't ask for directions.
You know. But, yeah, it's just, you know, it's the frustration where you know it's wrong and you don't know how to fix it. You're not sure where it all went, basically, sideways. So those are the toughest moments, I would say. And those are the moments where we stare at each other. We're like, man, you know.
No, yeah, I mean, but that's the thing. We go down to the office. When we're working on something, we try to have a schedule. We wake up. We have coffee or tea. We say hi to our kids if they're both here. Usually it's just one. And we walk down to our office, and we have one computer, and we sit down, and I'm usually behind the keyboard, and we just work until lunch. And then we have lunch and we go back. Sometimes we don't go back. We eat and we fall asleep watching terrible murder shows and we call it a day. But we have a goal. We do try to get 2,000 words a day. That's usually our working daily goal, is to get that 2,000 words.
It's either that or in the scene.
Yeah, sometimes it's just the scene, regardless of the length. We just try to get this. If we feel like we nailed that scene and we're both happy with it, then sometimes we can just call it a day.
Yeah, it's, you know, a lot of times people are like, well, word count, word count. It's not really the words you write, it's the words you keep. So if you wrote a good chunk and you know you're going to keep that and it's good, you know, then, hey, daily goal accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's good to give yourself some space, I think, for new ideas to bubble up. Probably just sitting at a desk without a pause isn't good. Well, I think you just answered the last question about you started writing in 2007, you're on a bestseller list, and how do you keep the novels coming out? You just shared your daily schedule with us, so you've got a space where you go to do your work and kind of agreed on ritual. So what are you guys working on now?
We're going to basically start work on the final book in Catalina's trilogy, which will be named Ruby Fever.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. If you say so.
And it basically will nicely conclude Catalina's story arc, and we'll find out what happened with her and Alessandro.
I did have one question. Why did you call this book 5 Emerald Blaze?
Well, it's actually kind of a funny story. We were in New York brainstorming the titles for Catalina trilogy. It was actually the two of us, our editor Erica Tseng with Avon Books, and our publicist Pam Chaffee. Our agent was there too, Nancy Yo. So we somehow ended up in this bar in New York, and we were basically sipping fruity drinks and
having smart cocktails.
Smart cocktails, as one does when in New York. And we were trying to figure out some kind of theme because, you know, since it's a trilogy, all the titles need to have a theme. And so it was decided, because the first Nevada trilogy had a theme of burning, you know, mm-hmm. that type of Burn for Me, and, you know, Wildfire. It was decided to kind of keep the element of fire, but they wanted to add a jewel to it. Well, once you add a jewel to it, there's a limited number of jewel names you can use. So the first Catalina book was named Sapphire Flames, which was like, yay, fairly quickly. And for the second
actually Diamond Fire.
Yeah, Diamond Fire was a novella. Sapphire Flames, and now, you know, for the Emerald Blaze, we knew we had to use either Emerald or Ruby, and since we have a swamp in this
green book,
we went with a green jewel.
Yeah, if you read the book, I feel like because of the swamp and the pit and everything, there's a definite green, and we thought that it's a weird consideration, but the green would look really good on the cover, too.
Yes,
like Emerald and Blaze and Green Fire, it would look really good.
Yeah, since it's so jewel-toned, it would look really pretty. We do reference the title in our books. If you read, you'll always find kind of an allusion to the title in the narrative. So, but yeah, that's why. And so this is why we ended up with Ruby Fever, because it was Ruby, you know, and everybody was expecting Ruby Inferno. But, you know,
that would have been good too.
It was a bit silly. So we went with Ruby Fever, yeah. Ruby Inferno. I mean, there is a limited amount of cheese we can do, right?
Yeah. No, we're pretty cheesy.
Well, guys, thanks so much for being on the show. And we'll look forward to your next book hitting the bestseller list soon.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you so much for having us.
Bye-bye. Thanks for listening to me today on the New Books Network in Fantasy and Adventure Channel. I've been talking to Gordon and Ilona Andrews about the fifth novel in their Hidden Legacy series, Emerald Blaze. February's interview will be with self-professed geek Mike Chen, the author of the quirky superhero novel, We Could Be Heroes, which is being released in January. I'm your host, Gabrielle Matthew, author of the YA fantasy, Girl of Fire, the first in the Brenna's Quest series. You'll find the podcast schedule on my website, GabrielleMatthew.com. You can also follow me on Twitter to get updates about new podcasts and more, at Gabrielle Author. My name is spelled G-A-B-R-I-E-L-L-E. Till next time.